everybody, this is JP Ross from In the Scene Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're a subscriber, welcome back. If you're new to the podcast, hey, thanks for listening. We hope that you like what you hear. Today's guest is Mike Crawford of Upstate Guide Service. Mike Crawford has been guiding the Adirondacks for a long time. We kind of joke a little bit on this podcast that he's going to be turning 50 this year, but he certainly doesn't act like it. He's an opinionated guy, and he's got a right to be because he's been out in the woods a lot and he's seen a lot of stuff change. But that's really why we wanted to have him on the podcast. And being an Adirondack guide is not an easy thing to do. Guiding in general is really hard because it's hard work. If you really want to make your clients happy, you got to do a lot of work, and you really got to be thinking about safety and having your mind in the game all the time. So we've got Mike Crawford here, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about guiding in the Adirondacks, why he chose to live this type of life that he is living, and he truly loves it. And you'll hear that in the passion in his comments and his wisdom about the outdoors and guiding. So thanks for tuning in today. The podcast is brought to you by JP Ross and Company, home of JP Ross Fly Rods. You can find us at jprossflyrods.com or smallstreamflyfishing.com. They both will take you to the same place. Please do check us out online. Subscribe to the podcast. You can check us on Instagram, Facebook, go online to our website and get our newsletter, and we'd love to stay in touch with you. Our goal is to send the message that it's important to get outside and nurture your soul. So here we go with In the Scene Podcast with Mike Crawford of Upstate Guide Service. Great to have you on the podcast, Mike. I hope you're happy to be here.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, you've been busy guy. Been seeing a lot of posts and stuff. Every time I talk to you, you're on the ice.
Yeah, it turned out, you know, to be the busiest ice fishing season I've ever had in, you know, 15 years of guiding on the ice. This one was crazy. I canceled more trips than I canceled more trips on the ice this season than I've ever canceled in my whole career.
Yeah, you said that. That's because of conditions, weather, or what?
Yeah, conditions and weather. It was brutal between the snow and the slush, and the cold. But
yeah, people probably don't want to do the cold, but I haven't done a lot of this whole ice fishing thing, and we got a lot to talk about today, but I am curious because yesterday it was almost 70 degrees and I'm sitting in my office and you're saying, oh, you're in your office looking out at the sunrise and you're out on the ice. I'm in the valley in the Mohawk Valley and you're up in the Adirondacks. There's obviously still ice up there. You're obviously safe, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And today, I think today probably would be it for up there. I know it's supposed to get cold over the weekend, but the ice was getting, actually, as I was coming off yesterday, there was still 20 inches of ice, but it was getting rotten. Mm-hmm. And so it was an apt finish to the season. And I don't think I could safely get another trip in, actually.
Yeah.
After yeah.
You ever get scared on the ice? I'm just curious.
No, I don't, I never, ever take people on unsafe ice. It's not an option.
Well, that's a good answer. I will say I went out with, Mark Usick and Wayne Weber, and we walked around an outlet, and there was like open water there, and Wayne's just like walking, and I'm like not comfortable. I'm not used to being on the ice. And it was like, you're like a deer in the headlights. All of a sudden you're like, I don't feel safe anymore, but I just kind of like trusted everybody and went along with it. And then, we drilled holes and there was plenty of ice out there. But anyway, so Mike Crawford, Upstate Guide Service, the one and only, there's not a lot of Adirondack guides left and you're one of them. I'm glad that I know you. So, first of all, I always have people kind of open up. You're already talking, but a little bit about yourself and how you became a guide. If you can give us kind of like a bio and how you, long you've been in business and why you became a guide. Can you tell us?
Yeah. I can honestly, it sounds kind of sappy, but I can honestly say I've always wanted to be a guide since as long as I can remember. And I think that's because I was introduced to the Adirondacks and that whole world of sporting, fishing and hunting up in those mountains by my father when I was just a little kid. And, it really stuck. Hanging around with my father and all his friends up there in the woods, fishing for trout in the spring and hunting for deer in the fall, it just got in my blood. And I was fascinated with the region, we used to go to the Old Forge, Central Adirondacks, Lime Kiln, Moose River Plains. That area is where I kind of grew up. And as I got older in my teenage years, I just became more and more fascinated with the whole concept of it. And I would read the books, I couldn't get my hands on enough books about the Adirondacks. And of course you can't get into those books without reading stories about these old guides, Alva Dunning and Plumlee and these guys. And I just really became fascinated with it. And when I turned 18, I moved to Saranac Lake and I took, I entered a 2-year program at North Country Community College, and the program was Wilderness Recreation Leadership. And that really gave me, it had a couple of practicums, which were in the field. So my second autumn there, we went into the woods for 33 days straight.
Oh my God.
And after that, I was pretty much hooked on the wilderness. I mean, the wilderness became, for lack of a better analogy, it became really a drug to me. Like I seeked it and searched it out wherever I was. And after I left Saranac Lake in 1993, of course, it took me 3 years to get a 2-year degree. I was a little preoccupied in college with hunting and fishing. But after I left Saranac Lake, I spent a year in the Canadian wilderness, which is a whole nother story in and of itself. I don't know if that's a kind of a roundabout answer, but I've always really wanted to do it. And in 2003, I went and got my license. So I was 32. So I really dragged my feet for a long time. And I never really looked at it as an occupation. I just looked at it as something I wanted to do and I was going to do it the right way. So, I got the license and took the test. And
yeah. So sometimes people get into guiding and I don't know if they know what guiding is all about. Were you around guides to know what guiding was all about? Or was it kind of like you just went and did it and you learned along the way? Did you have any role models for guiding?
I did. Of course, the teachers I had when I studied wilderness recreation in Saranac Lake back in the early 90s, those guys, Brian McDonald, Max Canoe Outfitters, Jack Drury, Wayne Failing from Middle Earth Expeditions in Lake Placid, who's one of the greatest legendary guides in the Adirondacks of all time, those guys I met when I was young, and I learned some stuff from them, and it kind of stuck. None of it really pertained to fishing or fly fishing, had nothing to do with fly fishing. Most of it was just like, how to travel in the backcountry, leave no trace, keep yourself in the people that you're with safe, leadership and judgment and decision-making. Those are the basic elements of what I do today. It has nothing to do, it doesn't have anything to do with catching trout on flies, but every time I take somebody on the ice or down a river or, into a pond, all those things I learned back then, they come into play.
And you make it pretty clear that, not in a bad way, but you are in charge, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm making the decisions that have to, that are the key to everybody having a safe, enjoyable and successful time. And so, and people, the reason they hire a guide is because they need somebody to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's funny. Yeah. I think it's funny when, you know, I get a lot of folks from New York City and other places downstate. And as a rule, guys from New York City, a lot of them, I don't mean anything derogatory, but they're used to calling the shots. You know, and sometimes I'll get people who are like, yeah, I think we should do this. And I just look at them like, you've never been anywhere near this place ever before in your life. And how you can have an opinion on what we should do next is mind boggling to me. But I accept that. And I would never say that. I take it all in stride, but I think, you know, that's the reason why people hire guides. It's not always because they want to catch big fish. It's because they, you know, they need to feel insurance about what they're doing.
So Mike, go back to like your first year learning this whole thing. Cause I guided a little bit. I did it enough to know that I like to be outside and didn't really necessarily enjoy guiding, but I did it. It's not easy. Your first couple clients, first half a dozen clients, when you really start booking them, it gets tiring and stuff too. The first year, do you remember that? Do you even remember it, or is it a blur?
Oh yeah. Oh, I do. That was the year my son was born. You know, I have a lot of stories. We could talk for hours about stories that have happened to me while guiding. But that year, I remember I had bought a boat. I was on the lake, and I had a guy and his wife and a teenage son. They were from Georgia. They were from down south or something. And it was like an April day, and it was raining and cold. And I bumped the kill switch on my control panel of my boat. Now, the kill switch means, you know, you push that and the outboard will not start. But I did not know I bumped the kill switch. So I spent about an hour trying to start my motor and drifting around in the rain with these poor people. And finally, like, had to paddle the boat over to a dock, tie it up, and ask the people whose house the dock was attached to if I could use their phone to call my wife to come pick us up. So, I mean, that's a disastrous, you know, that's kind of a disastrous trip right there. The people were good natured and nobody got hurt and everything was fine, but you know, what an amateur mistake, right? Of course, I go back after the people, my wife drives them back to the village, to their hotel, and I go back to the boat, and it dawns on me, it's the kill switch. It was just a button that I had to push.
Yeah. Right? You learned that one hard way though, right? I mean, that's how it goes.
Yeah. You know, that was my first year. That was the spring of 2003. I was always like with the guiding, I didn't jump into it not knowing what I was doing. I felt pretty confident about what I had to offer. You know, I had spent enough time doing it without a guide's license that when I decided I would guide, you know, I felt confident in what I was doing, but you know, there's still trial and error.
Well, so we're already talking about fishing and stuff, but you're not just a fishing guide, are you?
No. I'm doing, we do waterfowling. This past season, I've acquired some private farmland. So I'm probably going to do some more turkey and deer that I've never really done. I mean, I've been turkey hunting and deer hunting my whole life, but I've never offered to guide people because I always thought it was too challenging. And having, you know, 600-700 acres of private land is also an asset to that. I'll probably do more of that. And, you know, the couple of arenas that I don't get into is hiking and camping, although camping gets incorporated into a lot of my fishing trips and it's good, but I don't do, you know, paddling or hiking. Pretty much all my trips are centered around hunting or fishing.
Right. And the Adirondacks is a pretty big place. And are there, you know, places that you go and places that you kind of don't go? Will you go anywhere? Do you always, you know the place that you're going? Do you ever explore with clients? Can you talk about that?
No, I rarely explore with clients. I rarely explore. In fact, yesterday I was, you know, fishing wasn't great on Saturday or Sunday. And so Monday I had a trip and I was debating, you know, I wanted to guide a lake that I hadn't guided before. And at the end of the day, my decision was no. Because at the end of the day, even though the fishing may have been better on that other lake, I'm not going to lead people onto ice in the late season without a very thorough knowledge of where we are doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I don't feel comfortable, then I'm not doing it.
Right. So Mike, let's talk about the Adirondacks a little bit, and you've guided and traveled. I don't know if you've guided outside the state. You may have, but I know you've traveled, and I want to talk a little bit about the Adirondacks because I still feel like when I talk to others about the Adirondack Park and people listen to this podcast from all over the world, the Adirondacks is a pretty cool place. And you talked about that you did a little bit of time in Canada, and I've spent a little bit of time in Canada, and there are some places that I kind of correlate a little bit with Canada and the Adirondacks. But in your words, the Adirondacks are different, and you can talk about ecosystems and whatever you want to talk about that makes it different. And I believe that it's actually pretty rugged country, but you've got a lot more experience than I do. Can you take, 5-10 minutes and talk about how the Adirondacks is different and what it means to you? And you have seen a lot of places through your eyes, how you compare it.
Yeah. First of all, you are very experienced too, so don't sell yourself short. I know that you have a lot of time in those mountains.
And I don't think I've seen as many places on this planet as you have, though. I'll be honest with you.
Well, as far as the Adirondacks go, I have my areas, and there's a lot of the park that I don't guide. It's huge, and I have my regions, Central Adirondacks, the Racket Lake, Old Forge Inlet area, and then the Northwest, the Saranac Lake, the Saranacs, that region, the canoe area. The Adirondacks are absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I was driving, I was driving around the mountains just yesterday, and it's just stunning, the landscapes and the scenery. The whole atmosphere of it has just always been in my blood. I think right now it's going through another big transition, and I'm a little worried about it. It's getting loved to death again. When I moved to the Adirondacks in 1990, I studied, leave no trace principles and stuff like that, low impact camping, and it was popular. And outdoor recreation was popular, but now it's exploding. And I think there's a real need for education up in the park right now. I don't know who's, that's my responsibility as a guide. And I take every opportunity with everybody I meet to tell them how important it is to treat this place with respect. But I'm just, one guide. And I'll be honest with you right now, after COVID hit and after what I saw this past summer, after what I saw just this past weekend at the boat launches, after all the snow melted, the garbage, the trash, the litter, unbelievable. Never seen anything like it before until this year. And that's kind of breaking my heart a little bit. It's getting, the more popular infrastructure, campgrounds and lakes in areas are getting extremely high use right now. And it shows. The backcountry, not so much, the wilderness of the Adirondacks is, I could sum this up with how I feel about the Adirondacks is that I go to places that I went to 20 years ago and they're exactly the same. And I know that my son can go there 10 years from now and they're going to be exactly the same. And that, that's the magic of the wilderness, but it's also the magic of the Adirondacks. It's just, it transcends space and time. A lot of the places that I go to, they're like old friends,
Yeah. I sometimes get a little bit sad when I leave.
Yeah, me too.
And like all of a sudden my phone blips back on and I don't know who I think I was on. I just did a podcast the other day with Peter Buchanan Smith. And I talked about how I was scared that in New York, we were eventually going to get to a point where there wasn't an off-grid place to go. Yeah. And I hope that we're not stupid enough that we put the ability to communicate everywhere. I know from a safety standpoint, listen, I get it, but you know, it's, I think our soul needs to have places where you don't have a digital connection.
Yeah.
That's
oh,
how
yeah.
I feel, you know, but that's a good, I thank you for talking about that. And the next topic in association with the Adirondacks is an Adirondack guide. And I would urge everybody, and I'm sure that you will run through some names, but there's a lot of really great guides out there that have been written about in the turn of the century. And I'm sure you've got some favorites, and I'd like you to talk about that. And also how you associate how an Adirondack guide is different and unique. I'm not going to say that they're any better, because I'm sure people out west in Alaska and in Patagonia are going to say that, you know, they're different, and they thank God they are different. But talk about what makes you feel like an Adirondack guide is unique.
Well, I mean, you have to be, there's skill sets that you need to be guiding in the Adirondacks that you may not use in other places. You know, backcountry travel, cooking, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't really apply to fly fishing for steelhead or, you know, in other watersheds or other fisheries in New York. You know, guiding it came from the Adirondacks. That's where in modern society, I think that's where it kind of evolves, you know, because of the railroads and the wealthy folks from New York City developing the Adirondacks. You know, the Adirondack guide was a byproduct of that, and a very unique one. I think what separates an Adirondack guide, you know, there's this thing, which in my mind, you know, it's like the elephant in the room. Well, I'm not from the Adirondacks. I wasn't born and raised there. So can I call myself an Adirondack guide? Well, I do, because that's, I spend 55, 60% of my time up there guiding, and I have for almost 20 years. So yeah, you know, I consider myself one. I don't think you have to be born and raised in the Adirondacks to be an Adirondack guide. And there's, trust me, a large majority of licensed guides in the Adirondacks, and a large percentage of them aren't from there, which can give the whole, you know, concept and idea of Adirondack guide kind of a weird twist, and leaves a weird taste in some people's mouth. If you know what I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I've always battled with that a little bit, but I don't anymore. You know, I feel I have confidence in what I do up there. I know I've met enough, have a lot of good friends up there. And, you know, when I became a full-time guide in 2013, it's just about putting days on the calendar and where is my market. And just like guiding was a market in 1890, guiding is a market in 2021 in the Adirondacks. It'll always be there. There'll always be a trade for the guides up there. And, you know, just like in 1890, same as 2021, if you're good at it, you stand out.
Yeah. Mike, it's it's funny, because while you were talking, I just was curious, when I knew Saranac Lake was settled pretty early in it, and I looked up that it was settled in 1819. Mm-hmm. And, Lewis and Clark started their expedition in 1804. And I never even thought of this, but you brought it to mind. I think you're right. Guiding may have actually started in the Adirondacks. I mean, think about it, right? Saranac was settled in roughly the same time that the Lewis and Clark expedition was going on. That's pretty cool. So
you're well versed. They're a product of the Adirondacks, and it's a trade. That's how I look at what I do. It's a trade, like just like an electrician or a plumber. I mean, you could be good at it, or you can just kind of whittle away at it over the course of your life. Or you can, yeah. You know, or you can make it your profession. And I think, you know, sometimes I may be construed as slightly arrogant in some of the things that I publish or write, but I feel like the real deal is somebody who guides full time, and I've been guiding full time now for 7 years, and it's like, it's what I do. So it's a little bit different than, you know, I've heard this term thrown out there by some other guides, side hustle, which I hate that term, but I hate it because I would never want the trade of guiding to be categorized that way.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to put it, that you feel like it's not. And that's probably why you still have been in business for 7 years, by the way, guiding full time, even though you started much, much sooner than that. But I'm going to change gears for a second, because I want you to teach me about smelt. Yeah. I don't know a lot about them. There used to be a good run on our lake where our camp is. I don't know if it's still going on. The only thing I can tell you is there have been times I've gone out in the morning and I have seen dead smelt near the inlet of the lake. And I don't want to disclose too much other than these things. What are these things called, smelt, and why are they so important? Because they are pretty important. As you know, I don't know that much about them and I haven't hit too many runs. I know that they're gosh darn important. So can you teach us and me about smelt for a second, please?
So smelt are forage based, right? They're related to the trout family. They have an adipose. I'm almost 90% sure of that. I should be 100%, but they're related to the trout family, but they're not trout. They're a bait fish, and they're the basis of the food chain in the big lakes where they exist. You know, you have a lake that has smelt, and then you have big trout. If you have a lake without smelt, not so much, because, you know,
deal breaker.
They're like steak, you know, they're like the steak of the lake. And the big trout, even brookies, but especially Lakers, once those Lakers and brookies get mature enough to consume the smelt, which can be anywhere, you know, when they're mature, you know, they can be at 5 inches long or even bigger, you know, they just start. Once the trout can consume that meal, they grow and they get big. And, you know, that's what everybody wants. So they run in about the next maybe 2 weeks. I think it has a lot to do with the moon more than anything else. But water temperatures probably plays a role too. So right around now, this time of year, they'll start to school up in huge schools and they'll stage near inlets. And then when the sun goes down, they'll run. And they'll do their spawning thing by the thousands. It's really cool to see, you know. And if you haven't done it, you should check it out, because it's kind of a fascinating.
Well, how do you see them? I'm just curious. Like, if I want to show this to Parker, so in the next 2 weeks. And another thing, by the way, I don't know if you can key me in on, but we don't have to talk about it. But there's also an amphibian migration, which I have targeted and tried to witness. That's another really cool phenomenon. But how do I take my son, my 5-year-old, to go maybe see some of these smelt? I think he'd love it.
Well, I the lake that your camp is on, it has a run. I don't know the health of the population of smelt in that lake. Okay, they're all different. You know, they're like a forage base. Their populations go up and go down. If you have a lake that has a good solid population of smelt, the major inlet to that lake, you know, you got to just keep tabs on it. It used to be, you know, years ago, everybody anticipated the smelt runs and the locals were keeping eyes on it. And when they started running, everybody went down and with nets and scooped up the smelt and ate them.
Is it a one night thing though? Like if they start running, do you have like
a few nights? Yeah. It's like anything. It's going to start a little bit slow and then it's going to peak and then it's going to peter off. In some lakes though, I think if it's a small lake that has a native population of smelt and that population's not very big, they might go up in one night and do their spawn and be done. If it's a big lake that's got a huge population of smelt, you know, they may trickle in until they peak and then trickle out, but they run at night. And meaning you can sit there and stare at that creek all day long and not see a smelt, come back at 10 o'clock at night and you can't fit another one in there. It's something to see.
Yeah. And what, after they spawn, do they still stay shallow so you can like fish around those places, for a few weeks, or once they spawn, do they just go right deep?
I don't know. I know the answer to that I can't completely give you a great answer to that, because I don't know, but I know that they spend most of their time in over 30 foot of water. So I don't think they, like other species that run up a creek and spawn, I don't think they linger around the mouth for any major, for any long amount of time. But I'll tell you what, for the period of time that they are lingering around the mouth, the big boys and girls are on their tail. That's the time to be throwing stream, you know?
So if they're going to spawn in maybe the next 2 weeks, then they may do it under the ice, huh?
Well, they typically run a creek. And they typically don't do it.
No, I mean, like, there could be ice on the lake and they run.
Yeah.
Can they run when there's ice on the lake?
Yeah, yeah, because they can, you know, the ice around the mouth of the creek is going to be open, flowing water. It's not going to be, there's no block, you know, they can swim from the lake under the, up the creek. But I, you know, I've never, it's usually right after ice out. I think most people that are familiar with it would agree. It's typically right after ice out, but it can be a tricky thing to time.
I've always wanted to hit it where they're staging up and you can catch like big lakers and stuff shallow, you know, casting shallow. I think that would be cool, but you got to know where they're going to run and you got to know that they're staging, you know? So I know it can be done. And by the way, I had another podcast on here with Bobby Helms and Tupper, and he openly talked that the smelt population in Tupper is very good. Mm-hmm. And I just would like to see them. You know how sometimes you just want to see wildlife just to know like that things are okay. It's not so much that I really want to fish as much as I just want to see them. Just like I like seeing the amphibian migration, which is a really cool thing. Cause you're like, oh my God, like, you know, the world is still okay. And it's a nice feeling. So, but well, thanks for the quick education on smelt. And I also, you know, we're documenting history because we're doing this podcast and we have a mutual friend, a guy that you introduced me to. He's real your friend than mine, although I hope he'd say that he's friends with Mark and myself after we spent time together. And that's Butch. And I think that you should take some time to tell the world about Butch, if you don't mind.
No, not
will,
at all.
Will he let you, you think?
Yeah, he'll get a huge kick out of it if I can get him to listen to this when he'll get a huge kick out. I just saw him the other night. We had dinner.
Oh, great. Tell us about him.
His birthday is, what's today? Tuesday. His birthday is tomorrow. He's going to be 77.
Okay.
So Butch was raised in a bar room in a little tiny town called Childwald, New York, in the middle of the wilderness, kind of, really. In fact, I think there is no more better town than that. That place is just surrounded by conifer forest for miles. But anyways, Butch was raised in a bar room. His mother ran the bar. And I think that shaped a lot of how Butch is these days. He doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, never has. And, but he's like he's third generation Adirondacker. And the stories that he tells, I'll tell you how I met him real quick. I was working as a seasonal forest ranger up at Lowe's Lake years and years and years ago. And the ranger I was working for, he was a real pisser. He was a big, tall Irish guy. And him and I, we didn't really get along that well. And he said to me, he said, your job is every person that comes in this Lowe's Lake is going to go by this spot right here. And he said, your job is to stay right here at this spot, 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, and don't go paddling up and down the lake. Well, here I was, you know, 21 years old with a brand new solo canoe, a fast one. And I thought, well, that's not going to work, right? So I started paddling up and down the lake. And one day I'm paddling up the lake a couple miles from, you know, where I'm supposed to be. And the ranger comes in and he didn't like it. He says, put your canoe in the back of my truck. I'm going to drive you back down. And I said, I don't really want to put my canoe in the back of your pickup truck and go 2 miles down this Jeep trail. It was a fiberglass polyester layup canoe. Put the canoe in there. Sure enough, by the time we got to where we were going, it was all banged up and smashed up and cracked up. So I looked at the canoe and I looked at him and he said, look, here's a guy. There's a guy I want you to visit. He'll take care of your canoe. Well, that was Butch Hassler. So I put that canoe on my truck, drove it to this Butch's house that the ranger told me where it was. And Butch came out, took a hand grinder to that thing. And in a half an hour had it ship shape and ready to go. And that became the beginning of one of the greatest friendships in my life. I got to know Butch very well over the years and found him to be, without a doubt, the greatest woodsman I've ever come across in all my travels. I've never met anybody who was so at home in the woods than Butch. So, in fact, he invited me to go caribou hunting with him years ago up in Quebec. And I think this was 2003 or 2004. And I went up there with him, and the outfitters were so impressed with Butch that they hired him as a guide. And for like 15 years, every year, Butch would leave the end of August and spend the whole month of September flying around the Canadian wilderness. Guiding people in caribou hunts, you know.
Did he bring the dog?
He didn't bring the dog. He didn't bring the dog, but there's nothing the guy can't fix, right? And they saw that.
Yeah, that's true.
And so they, you know, those guys saw that and they were like, well, this guy is pretty valuable. But other than that, you know, he's genuinely the real deal. He is a true Adirondacker, with all the stories and all the quirks and all the skills that you would think that kind of person would have. He has it. He is really the real deal. And it's been a pleasure to know him. I've learned so much from the guy. I still do. So cool. I'm glad you meet him.
I'm glad that Mark and I talked about that whole experience of doing the Oswegatchie River with you, which is how I met you. And you know, you saw us pull up in our Jeep and take out the drone, and I could see you guys, you know, you guys were completely sizing us up, and Butch has got his gun outside his pants, and you're like, okay, are these guys jerks or not? And you know, and you know how I kind of come off a little bit happy and excited, and people don't know if it's real until they, you know, get to know me. Hopefully they know it's real. But anyway, it was just funny because I was like, oh man, I don't, you know, how's he going to be? But after, as normally happens, you know, you get good people that appreciate and love the wilderness. You can sit in a boat with them. And there's not, you know, there's friends and there's people you can sit in a boat with. I learned that from Jeff Soller, who told me that. And it's true. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of people you can sit with in a boat for a whole day. And, you know, I watched him and I had just was in admiration because just like you said, he puts off this energy of such being at peace and at home in the woods. It's just really awesome. So I'm glad I got to experience that. And you know, I sent you some questions and stuff so that you kind of knew where we were going, and I'm going to jump to, do you remember when we were in the boat and you told us to shut up or no?
I don't. And I was listening to your podcast and you the other day that you had, and you mentioned it, and I don't remember that.
You didn't really tell us to shut up, but you were like, you know, if we could just be silent for like 30 minutes, we might hear some wildlife. And, and I was like, oh yeah, he's right. So, I did want you to talk about that because part of who you are as a guide is you are kind of teaching people and helping expose them to nature. And what are some things that you've seen people learn from being quiet and being absorbed into the woods? You got any stories?
I mean, yeah, I don't know if it's a learning thing or it's just an experience. And I think, you know, when you get in a canoe in the middle of nowhere, or even out on a lake in a boat, you know, it's solitude and you're immersed in the natural world. So why not just take it to the next level of let's just absorb this and take it in with our eyes and our ears and all our senses. So, you know, just chill, just relax, sit back and just take it all in. It's not about catching a fish really all the time. It's about experiencing the natural world and you know, people, they come from the city, they drive in their car, they jump out of the car, they get in my boat and they can't stop talking. And sometimes I try to, maybe I don't remember what I said to you guys, but I think I probably said it in a polite way. And I'll say, look, hey, let's just and look, and that's when you see the mink on the log, you know, or you hear that trout sipping flies, or you see the deer's tail flick in the bushes. And that's what I'm there for.
You taught me a lot too, about that. And that was great. You also taught me that some rivers wind more than others. That one was windy. I think there was, if I remember correctly, there was like 753 turns on that river, but I'm not sure. So Mike, this wasn't a question that I kind of prepped you for, but I love hearing stories, and you've spent so much time in the woods that you have had Mother Nature probably tell you a couple times that she's in charge. And oh, yeah. I was wondering if you could tell us a couple stories about the holy shit moments. You got a couple of those?
Let me think about that.
I've been in one flash flood and I've been in one microburst. In it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was in one ice flow also once, which actually was right near my house. I was a little kid on Sequoia Creek and there was an ice flow, and I remember seeing what ice can do in a river. But I'm giving you a little time to think if you.
Yeah, no, I'll be, and this may sound like and I do have a couple examples, but I'll give you this response too. I don't put myself in precarious situations anymore, or the people that hire me to take them. That sounds like, well, that's ridiculous. No, it's the truth. You know, I'm always kind of paying attention to the environment that I'm in or I'm about to go in. And I have a lot of respect for Mother Nature. I don't court her. I don't tempt her. I don't play with her.
Yeah. Storms come up though.
They do. And you got to have an eye on the sky. You know, you've got to be paying attention to that stuff. I don't get caught out in them. You know, a downpour in July when it's 85 degrees, no big deal. A thunderstorm, that's a different story. But you remember 96, the summer, was the summer 95, the blowdown, the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in a pup tent at Lowe's Lake that night. A tree came down, a tree so big you couldn't put your arms around it, came down on the outhouse 25 yards away from where I was hunkered down. Blew the outhouse into about 4,000 pieces. Yeah. So that,
I know that, I know what that's like.
Yeah. That was like, that was pretty white knuckled. I was scared that night. I was pretty scared.
I think I mentioned to you, when I was in one storm, we got down under a canoe and it was so treacherous that we had a tree blow down like right next to us. And we don't even remember hearing it. We either were scared completely shitless, or there was so much other stuff going on that we actually couldn't hear it. I'm sure you heard that hit the house, though.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It, you know, that was one of the most terrifying nights of my life. I mean, and Lowe's Lake did not get hit that bad. Where I was not the epicenter of that microburst, but it wasn't far away. And people were killed that night.
Yeah.
No. It was the scariest experience I've ever had in the woods, bar none. Yeah.
I mean, I used to fly in with Jim Payne. I started the fly shop in 97. So 99 or so, I started guiding. I don't know. My guide number is 3134, which I gave my pin to Doug Smith. But I remember flying through there and seeing all the trees down. Was that bad for the woods? Was there like termites or anything like that exploded, or was it okay?
I couldn't tell you really, because the meat and potatoes of that microburst took place in one of the most remote areas of the Adirondack Park that I don't really go in much. The Five Ponds, the Pepper Box, north of Stillwater. I've been in there a couple of times, but I haven't been in there. I have not been in there in a long time. Well, you and I and Mark and Butch went down through there, but we were on the river. But that was where we were. That was kind of the epicenter of that micro.
Well, we went under a lot of big trees.
Right. And those are definitely a result of that. You know, Butch was crazy enough to keep going in there after that blowdown. I mean, he'd go from Wanakina to Stillwater Reservoir in the jungle of down trees, miles and miles of down trees. I wish I had seen it. I never did, but he has stories to tell about it.
Amazing. You know? Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, so let's transition over to brook trout.
Yeah.
You love those guys, huh?
Yeah. They're my favorite all time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How come?
They're just so pretty, but you know, mostly because of where they live, you know, where they live. I mean, it's just nothing better than, you know, sitting down to a campfire and overlooking a pond with rising brook trout. That's my utopia. I mean, that's my favorite place in the world to be.
Do you like brook trout fishing on ponds more than rivers?
Yeah. I mean, I like the pond trout because they do tend to get bigger. But I think it's more the environment that I like about it. You know, there's nothing like an Adirondack pond, right?
I know. I found a website. I stalked you and typed your name in and hit images. And there's some pictures of you. You can tell that are like late, you know, late 90s or early 90s, I should say. You got like, you know, the hat on that says like Gore-Tex or something. And you got like the little string things on your glasses so that you don't lose them. And you can tell like, wow, Mike Crawford's been doing this for a while. It was a New York State page, actually, I think, that showed different state records and the history of those state records. But you have been doing this a while, and I did a lot of pond fishing, and I'm looking forward to doing a lot more pond fishing. And you know what, I feel that the brook trout fishing in the Adirondacks has gotten a lot better in the last half decade or so, thanks to the Clean Air Act and stuff, although there are places that we have issues with because of climate change. But what's your opinion on brook trout fishing? And I feel like that you can find them a little bit bigger nowadays. What do you think?
I think you can, you know, I think you can. The problem with the brook trout is it's still a prized, and you gotta be careful when you go down this road, but the hook'em and cook'em crowd really likes the brook trout too. They really like them.
Yeah.
And they get after them pretty good, you know, up in the Adirondacks. I look at what a state like Maine has done to protect their wild brook trout in ponds, specifically in the regulations, the no kill, you know, artificial only. And I just don't know why New York State just keeps dragging its feet in that direction. You know, the closest we can get is, you know, special regs, which still allows you to kill three of them over 12 inches or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, why not just make it artificial only catch and release? You know, why not? Why not protect some of the ponds, especially the ones that are maybe more easily accessed? I feel, and I might be crazy by saying this, but they can be very susceptible to overfishing.
Oh, God.
And yeah. And
of course they can be. I mean, yeah. Mike, come on. Like, really? I think about it. How overfished is a stream going to be when the big fish are 6 and 8 inches?
Right.
You know, I mean, somebody social media is a picture of a fish that's a pound and a half, 2 pounds. And they actually disclose where it was. And it's like, oh God, you know?
Yeah. You know, that's a whole nother topic, but I mean,
I don't want to go there.
Yeah. I wish, and they're going in the right direction. You know better than anybody.
I think that what you're saying is, I actually probably will drop a line to some of the people I know and say, I hope that you're going to do some focus group things like you did with trout stream planning, and we can hear more about the correlation. Maine is a good example of some good work, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. So This podcast is called In the Seam, as you know.
Right.
Has a lot of different meanings, right? About, you know, stuff in the seam. And in our case, as fly anglers, we put our fly in the seam's of currents quite a bit. And that's kind of where we look sometimes. And I sent you this asking you to, if you were thinking about it in regards to wisdom and stuff that you can share over the years. You're getting a little older now. I know that that's on your mind because we talked about it. You either are 50 or getting to 50 here, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this year, the big 50.
Yeah. So I'm going to celebrate with you, by the way, on that one, because I'll be 45. And for some reason, this one's tough. But so I want to hear, you know, you're a well-versed guy, you're a smart guy, and you're deep. And I want to know what is the kind of in the seam insight wisdom that you can share with us from being a real professional Adirondack guide, and you're 50 and you probably realize your body is getting a little older. So what's on your mind, man?
Yeah, no, I thanks for those compliments. That's very nice of you to say. Yeah, I'm not getting any younger, and it is on my mind. Like, you know, how long am I going to be able to keep this up for? And as far as that goes, the answer to that question is I'm going to do it as long as I can, you know, as long as I can, as long as my health holds up. As far as deep philosophical stuff, you know, I'll tell you, fly fishing has gotten popular again, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's a good thing. It's a great thing. And I start to sound old when I say stuff like this. But I think sometimes people are getting into it for maybe the wrong reasons, or maybe they're the right reasons, but maybe they haven't realized it yet. And I think you have to take a look at why you're standing in the stream. You know, our friend Mark, he's one of the greatest at being able to extrapolate feelings like that. But, you know, what are we doing there? You know, why are you there? Is it to, you know, catch a fish on that $800 rod with those $1,000 waders and that straight brimmed hat, you know, or are you there because you're to engage nature? And I think sometimes, you know, I wonder when I look at fly fishermen in a stream, I wonder if they can really even identify the birds and the trees that are around them. Is that a scale? No, but it's just kind of an example of, you know, understand the environment that you're in, learn about it, appreciate it, then you respect it, and then pass it on. That's how that goes. That's the goal. That's your goal. I know it is. Everybody knows that. And it's my goal, is pass it on. Show people what the real prize is of a day spent fly fishing. Yeah.
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 That's a great way to put it. So I get to listen to my guests talk about stuff, and then I get to think about what I think I heard. What is the wisdom in the seam? And what I heard from you is the means to an ends in regards to fly fishing has nothing really to do with fly fishing. It has a lot to do with being outside. You go fly fishing because you love fish, you love fishing, you want to be on the water, you want to be near the water, but it's not about the clothes or the rod.
Right.
I make rods. It's not about the rod. It's about kind of having that moment of reflection and absorption, right? While you're out there. I've been, you know, Parker sometimes goes up in his room and Paisley stays downstairs with mom and with Bobby Joe. And I listen to the Cornell app trying to, you know, hear the differences in the warblers and the finches and stuff like that. And there's some other sounds I've heard that I don't know what they are. And eventually I'm going to come across the bird and hear the call, and I'm going to realize that's what I was hearing. But I'm engaged in that. And my son is going, Dad, what are you doing? Right. He's 5. And I'm like, when we're outside, Parker, I want to know what birds those are, because it matters to me. And that means, and I can't hear those unless I'm outside. So I'm hearing Mike Crawford telling me that that's really what matters. And the other thing that resonates with me is, you know, friendship has a lot of different meanings as you get older. So, you know, you preface this and said, you know, I sound like I'm old. It's not that you're old. It's that you're a little wiser. And, you know, I've been married for a little while, not a long while, long enough that I can understand now the evolution of love. In that I enjoy being married because I kind of like have gotten to know this person that I live with and their flaws and my flaws, and it's getting easier. Sometimes it gets easier because you've been around them longer.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and sometimes marriage gets tough and sometimes it just doesn't work out anymore. And same thing with friendships, you know, real long friendships, when you can pick it up with somebody after a while and pick right up where you were before. Isn't that kind of like that place in the Adirondacks that you said, you know, you can go see 20 years from now and it's the same. It's your friend, right?
Right. You know what to expect. It is. And, you know, that's how nature should be. That's why you should be standing in a stream fly fishing, because you want to create a relationship with the outdoor world that you become super comfortable in. And it brings you to a place, you know, that you need. Cause I think that everybody needs to engage the natural world. And if they don't, they're really missing out. And, you know, one other thought was competition. Anytime you take more than one grown man and ask him to do something, competition gets involved. And I appreciate the opportunity to share this opinion. Competition has nothing to do with hunting or fishing or the natural world. It doesn't fit in. You know, it's like the word client in the trade of guiding should never be used. It doesn't fit in. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't belong. In competition doesn't belong. In fly fishing, in duck hunting, in anything. And I really, that is a topic that doesn't get talked about much, but I tell you, it's just part of human nature that we want to make things, we want to prove that we're better at something than the next guy. And that is a stigmatism. That is a part of fishing and hunting that needs to be put to rest once and for all. There's no place for it. It's not a game. It's not a sport, hunting and fishing. Think about that. It's a pastime. It's an activity that brings us closer to nature, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good.
So thanks for letting me.
It's a good closing thought. You're welcome. No, you're welcome. I listen to a lot of podcasts too, from like Andy Mill and some of the guys that do the Golden Fly tournaments and stuff down in the Keys. And I'm not sure how I feel about those tournaments. And I've run tournaments, you know, I've done trout power tournaments and stuff. I actually had an undermining reason to do them, by the way. Which we can talk about.
You know, there's, I think behind every tournament, and you have to give credit to that, behind every tournament is a conservation effort. I get that. And I don't really have a moral.
It's okay. I think it's a good point what you made. I think it's a good point to make. It doesn't have to be the closing point though. I think the closing point is back to, you know, it's a pastime. And treat it like a pastime. And I think that that's really cool. So,
yeah.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot for being on In the Seam podcast. I hope you had a good time.
I did. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you did.
Always fun talking to you. I love our conversations all the time.
Thanks a lot.
Well, we did it again on In the Seam podcast, didn't we? We got a little bit deep. But that happens when you get passionate. You start to think about life a little bit differently. And that's the point. About In the Seam podcast, we kind of get a little bit into the seams and into the fringes and try to talk about the little nuances of life. So Mike is kind of a romantic, passionate, old soul type of guy. He's got old bones, that Mike Crawford, but good for him. And you really should consider looking him up, upstateguideservice.com. Mike, it really is a great guide, and it's amazing what you see happen to him when he gets like just 300 yards away from the car. He really gets in the element, and that's what makes him a great, great guide. Well, thanks a lot for tuning in, and once again, please make sure you hit that subscribe button. Please give us some feedback. Check us out on jprossflyrods.com. Get outside, simply fish, nourish your soul by being with nature. Unplug. Thanks a lot. Have a great, great day.